A reminder, because it's been a while, that stocks go down too, you know. From American Public Media, this is MarketFlex. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, today, 8 September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So look, a couple of things here. Number one, stocks go down too, as I was saying. It's easy to forget, and people are always surprised when it happens, but it is literally the way things are supposed to work, up and down. Number two, the major indices had been at or near record highs for weeks, going on months now, with nearly 30 million people getting government unemployment benefits. What's been happening the last couple of days was overdue. It's simple as that. Three, and last, yes, the August job numbers we got on Friday were good, but of those tens of millions of people who were out of work, there's a growing fear that a lot of what had been expected to be temporary furloughs are turning into permanent and very real layoffs. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab gets us going.
Cameron Tabrizi, a preschool teacher in Seattle, was on furlough all summer. And here's how he describes his job outlook from start to finish.
Pragmatically grim to growing into existential despair.
The pandemic dragged on, and he knew he had health issues that could prevent him from going back to work if his employer wanted him back. In August, after 5 months on furlough, he got the call.
They said, we can either lay you off or you can come into work. And they gave this as a mass option to everyone that had been furloughed.
Tabrizi took the layoff, and he was sort of prepared for it. The longer the pandemic lasted, the more he figured he would not be able to go back to work. And this matches up with reality, says Matt Nodowadigdo, a labor economist at the University of Chicago.
A worker that's on temporary unemployment, every month they have about a 10 to 15% chance of transitioning to a permanent separation.
Let's see, we're almost entering month 7 of the pandemic, so it makes sense that many furloughs are now becoming layoffs. But Heidi Scherholz at the Economic Policy Institute says we're at a new turning point. Job losses are spreading from industries decimated by lockdowns, like hospitality and tourism, and into others that weren't initially as sensitive.
Businesses that maybe thought that they were going to be fine, unaffected by any social distancing measures, are now looking up and saying, yeah, we didn't have a problem then, but now we're just seeing demand for goods and services more broadly has just been depressed.
She says at this point in the pandemic, minimizing job loss is about boosting spending, something that became more difficult for families once that extra $600 a week in unemployment benefits went away. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
This one is from the We All Have Our Hobbies file. Mariel Segarra, she covers retail for us. She likes to read through transcripts from corporate earnings calls. Really. And she's noticed a trend. Retailers keep using the word conservative in the business sense, not the political sense. Here's Marielle.
Earnings calls can be kind of opaque. There's a lot of corporate lingo. But if you listen closely, you can pick up some things.
We're going to be conservative on inventory.
We will continue to plan our businesses conservatively.
I think everybody's taking a pretty conservative approach from an inventory standpoint.
Those were executives from Abercrombie, Urban Outfitters, and Dick's Sporting Goods. Conservative here means cautious. Going into the fall and the holidays, retailers are being cautious about what they buy. They're trying to avoid a repeat of this spring. When the pandemic hit, sales plummeted and they had a ton of inventory left over that they paid for and couldn't sell. They had to offer steep discounts to get rid of it. Craig Rowley at Korn Ferry says when you do that,
you can lose all the profits you've gained through the whole season.
So this time around, with all the uncertainty, retailers are just buying a lot less. Sonia Lipinski at Alex Partners says it is a risky bet because if they're wrong, they could miss out on potential sales.
This is their peak selling season. And given such a year of turmoil that we've had, it's really risky for them to run out of stock and just miss that top line.
Lipinski says some shoppers will likely be disappointed this year and find out something they want is sold out. Because the other problem is there's no historical precedent here. Retailers can't just look back at last year's sales and say, okay, I should order this many winter coats or that many patio heaters or sleds. We're in a new reality. So they've been making a lot of guesses.
you know, what are going to be the hot items? What are going to be the things that consumers really want? And likely they're just not going to have the right bets in all cases.
Several retailers said that they could always try to buy more products during the season if stuff starts selling out. Or in the language of earnings calls, they could chase inventory in their supply chains to feed demand. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
No, come on. That was great. Chase inventory. Oh, man. I'm going to say this again. Stocks go down too, y'all. Details, numbers, you know the drill. When you think about the past decade, maybe two decades, there's just a handful of companies that have really had outsized influence on the way we live. Amazon, yes, for sure. Uber, Apple, and Facebook, too. Also, Netflix. It took out Blockbuster. It pretty much invented the streaming model that everybody in Hollywood, from Disney to HBO to NBC, is chasing. Reed Hastings is the co-founder. He's the chairman and the co-CEO of Netflix. And he is also now an author. His book out today is called No Rules Rules, Netflix and the Culture of Reinvention. Reed Hastings, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
I read somewhere as I was preparing for this talk that you have said you knew back in like 1996, 97, in the days of red envelopes and DVDs going out, you knew that this is where this company was going to wind up, delivering nonlinear television or content over the internet. Is that true?
How lucky can one person get? In 1988, I got a job. No, 1986. In 1986, I got a job serving coffee as a first job in a computer company. And it happened to be the very first .com ever. And in that company, I learned so much about the internet that by the time we started Netflix in 1997, I realized the internet was going to continue to get faster and faster and eventually be able to do television. And so, yes, we knew, and DVD was a temporary option for us, and it worked very well.
Yeah, clearly it did. I would say so. Much has been written and said about how much money this company spends on getting those new shows and new content. And I wonder... Of the things that keep you up at night running this globally influential company, where does the amount of money you have to shell out for content rank?
You know, we're spending this year about $15 billion developing new content, so it is quite a lot. And we're very thankful that then our subscribers watch all of our content and then, you know, send us 10 bucks a month to be able to fund even more content development.
But the beautiful part, it seems to me, of Netflix and honestly your competitors as well, but let's talk about you, is that it almost, yes, it's great to have the hits, right? Like The Crown and all the rest of them. But it almost doesn't matter because you have what you have called unlimited airtime, right? You can keep it in the back catalog and people will keep coming back for it. And that seems like a great luxury and competitive advantage.
You know, the internet has that infinite shelf space aspect that makes it able to support really broad selection. And so that's what empowers us to have a huge variety of shows, depending on whatever country you live in.
Can we talk for a second about this book that you've written? And I want to dig into it the way I think you intended it to be read, which is a discussion of, yes, Netflix, but also how you run this company and the company culture. It is famously described as cutthroat is probably pejorative, but it's harsh and does not tolerate second-rate performers. And you've been really candid about it, right? I mean, you released the whole PowerPoint deck on it 8-10 years ago. You're writing a book about it now. Do you worry that Netflix, for all of its successes, suffers from its reputation as a really difficult place to work?
If you look at the employee satisfaction studies, we rank at the very top. The people who work at Netflix love it. It may not be for everyone, but for 300 years, people have built companies to be like factories, very top-down, very efficiency-oriented. And now there's a lot of creative work, where instead of supervising employees, which is the factory way, we look to get them to create new concepts. And we manage on the edge of chaos. But the benefit of that is great creativity, which is what's helped us adapt from the DVD era forward.
Who gets to decide in this company? I mean, you famously took on Ted Sarandos, who used to be chief content guy, and he's now the co-CEO with you. Who makes the decisions in this company?
So a perfect quarter for me would be a quarter where I've made no decisions. I've only influenced people. I've advocated. I've inspired. I've learned. We don't do by command. That's sort of the factory era. We do by influence.
I'm so interested in this factory era comparison because, yes, we're transitioning to a knowledge economy and things are changing and creators now are so important, but it can't work everywhere in this economy, right?
Correct. And any part of the economy that's around mass replication with very little variance, like creating antibiotics, things that are safety critical, like airlines and hospitals, you want to be very process oriented. Then there's what used to be a very small sector of the economy, the creative sector, but now growing, where it's fundamentally about ideas and generating, stimulating human creativity.
Last thing, Reed, and then I'll let you go. And it gets us back to the beginning of this conversation where you, as first mover in the space, you know, took out Blockbuster, right? Who are you worried about? Who's your competition? Are you worried about getting Netflixed, I guess?
YouTube, TikTok, augmented reality. I think we'll do pretty well against Disney and HBO. We're all going to be in it for a long time. The threats that get you are often the substitution threats, the things that you really didn't spend a lot of time on. And so those are the ones that we worry about in the long term.
Reed Hastings is the founder, the chairman, the co-CEO now of Netflix. He's got a new book out about that company, how he runs it, and what its culture is. It's called No Rules Rules, Netflix and the Culture of Reinvention. Reed, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
It's an honor. Thank you, Kyle.
We've got an excerpt from Reed Hastings' new book about the time he offered to sell Netflix to Blockbuster for $50 million, which, looking back, would have been a great deal for Blockbuster, right? It's at marketplace.org. The beauty superstore Ulta is launching a new television campaign this week touting the restorative powers of personal care during the pandemic. It's the company's first TV try at getting customers back since it's pulled all of its ads back at the beginning of this thing. And look, with stores closed for months and millions of people working from home and some barely leaving the house or wearing masks when they do, beauty revenues in that industry are expected to drop about 30% this year. That's according to one analyst's estimate. But as Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino reports, not all segments of the beauty business have been equally blemished.
For years, it's been conventional wisdom in the beauty industry. When the going gets tough, consumers get lipstick.
It is an inexpensive way to sort of keep up an appearance.
Juliette Shore is an expert on consumer culture at Boston College. She says strong lipstick sales during periods of economic stress have been viewed as a sign that consumers want affordable luxuries.
The idea that these are small purchases that can have big psychological impacts.
Of course, lipstick doesn't go great with those surgical face masks, and cosmetic sales have dipped, says Jonathan Greenway, a consultant with Alex Partners. But now,
there's a much larger focus on anything above the mask.
Eye makeup has remained a bright spot, he says, with consumers interested in trying out more experimental, colorful looks while stuck at home. And though people are going out less, that doesn't necessarily mean they're less fixated on their appearance.
I'm on camera now more than I've ever been in my life.
Carlos Zavala, a communications consultant in Washington, D.C., says he spent more on skincare during the pandemic than ever before. With constant video meetings, he's been scrutinizing his under-eye bags and dry skin. Plus, he has more time to try out masks. No, the other kind of mask.
Sheet mask, clay mask. It definitely fills a lot of the wrinkles.
And his cucumber green tea scented face mist really helps calm the nerves while doom scrolling the news. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Coming up. Overall, the 15 Merkel years were rather good years for the German economy.
What about the next 15, though, huh? First, let's do the numbers. Yeah, the Wawas, you knew it. Dow Industrial's down 632 today, 2.2%, 27,500. The NASDAQ off 465 points, that is 4.1%, 10,847. The S&P 500 retreated 95 points, 2.7%, ended things at 3331. The tech sector sell-off continued as the new week begins. Facebook and Amazon both down more than 4%. Microsoft off more than 5%. Apple down more than 6%. General Motors is taking an 11% stake in the electric truck maker Nikola, which is based in Phoenix and specializes in electric big rigs. Nikola surged more than 40%. Today, GM rose 7.9%. Elsewhere in EV land, Tesla shares cratered more than 21%. Today, you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I'll tell you what, your pet project that you've been working on for years grosses $146 million the first couple of weeks it's on sale. That'd be a pretty good day, right? But when you're the Christopher Nolan hoped-for blockbuster Tenet, $146 million's kinda meh. Big end-of-summer holiday weekend, you would want to blow the doors off the box office. But given everything, word is the Tenet's performance might be a sign that Hollywood is on the rebound. Marketplace's Jasmine Garz has that one.
$20.2 million. On any given day, that's chump change for a U.S. and Canada movie premiere. But with a pandemic still raging, experts say Tenet did okay. Professor Arun Sharma from the University of Miami says there are two lessons from the last couple of months in movie premieres. First, some movies are just better off premiering on streaming only.
If it's a children's movie, the data is very clear. Launching it is a good idea.
Which is why Disney Plus just released Mulan on its platform for $30. But Sharma says there's not a lot of data on how movies for grown-ups do with a streaming premiere. Which leads to lesson number two. If it's not a kid's film, push the release date back. Because most movies aren't going to be highly anticipated, helmed by acclaimed directors. And plenty of films that are all that have still pushed back.
Your reputation precedes you.
I have to admit, I wasn't expecting an invitation back.
That's right. Top Gun fans that waited over 30 years for a sequel are going to have to just wait one more until 2021. Frank Patterson is the president of Pinewood Atlanta Studios, where Marvel movies are filmed. Right now, production is only resumed at around 30% capacity there. But Patterson is cautiously optimistic. He says the industry constantly weathers challenges. Actors drop out. Deals die.
You know, our pivot skills are legendary in the movie business.
There's optimism out there. Tenet cost $200 million to make and has so far grossed close to $150 million worldwide, almost breaking even. And these days in Hollywood, that's a good look for opening weekend. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
There's news of Brexit today, which it's been a long time since we've heard that on this or really any other program. It's weedy, as Brexit tends to be. Suffice it to say, Prime Minister Boris Johnson over in the UK is trying to find an edge in his country's relationship with the European Union, and it's not going so well. We, though, are going to Germany today for our EU story. Chancellor Angela Merkel has been in power there for 15 years through a series of economic challenges, a refugee crisis, and now a pandemic. She has said she is done after the end of her fourth term next year. So Marketplace's Stephen Beard has been talking to some German economists to see what happens next.
Angela Merkel's approval rating has soared over her handling of the pandemic, and not just for keeping Germany's death rate much lower than other large European countries, less than a quarter that of France, less than a fifth that of Britain. Marcel Fratscher is head of Germany's leading economic think tank, the DIW.
Confidence among consumers, among companies, is stronger than in many other European countries. So I think overall, the government has handled the crisis quite well from an economic perspective.
In spite of her tight-fisted approach to public spending, Merkel pumped $1.2 trillion into protecting workers and companies. Aside from the pandemic, says Michael Wolgemuth of the University of Wittenherdecke, her economic scorecard looks impressive.
Overall, the 15 Merkel years were rather good years for the German economy, especially when compared to most of our neighbours.
While French and Italian living standards have either stagnated or fallen, Germans are on average 20% better off than when Merkel came to power. But Wolgemuth doesn't give Merkel all the credit.
It is not governments that produce wealth and jobs, but workers and entrepreneurs.
Certainly many voters didn't reward Merkel for the buoyant German economy at the last general election 3 years ago. Despite her jolly campaign music, Merkel's election result in 2017 was dire. She almost lost power, thanks to her earlier decision to allow more than 1 million Syrian refugees and other migrants into the country. "Send them home," howled this angry crowd at one of many anti-immigration rallies. "Whoever makes it to Germany can stay here forever," said the man with the megaphone. "Are we living in a madhouse?" Professor Gustav Horn from the University of Duisburg, Essen, says Merkel didn't do enough to allay German fears over the influx.
Many people felt very insecure by such a mass of people entering in such a short period of time. In a way, she did the right thing, but she did not explain it very properly to the people.
But today, the protests have largely disappeared. And, says Marcel Fratscher, the process of integrating those 1 million migrants is well underway.
Almost half of refugees who have come have jobs now or are in training. Children are very well integrated.
Other critics of Merkel's 15-year tenure focus on the physical fabric of Germany under her stewardship.
In terms of infrastructure, if you look at the roads and the bridges, the conditions are often quite poor.
That's Stefan Legger, a German-born lecturer in economics at the University of St. Gallen in Switzerland.
The other day we read that just 1 in 10 bridges in Germany is in a good condition. The public train system is a running joke. I mean, if it's running at all.
And among the other structural economic problems Merkel has not addressed, says Marcel Fratscher, Germany's over-reliance on manufacturing and exporting, and its failure to maintain a lead in the businesses of the 21st century.
In all digital sectors, German companies are lagging behind those in the US and many parts of Asia.
But none of the economists we've consulted say Merkel's leadership has been below par, far from it. Germany's economy grew by over a third during her tenure, 1.5 times the growth rate of its nearest EU rival, France. Merkel survived at least 4 major economic crises. And after 15 years, she's still on top. At the European desk, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which Big Brother really is watching and has ruined Halloween in the process, saw this on Reuters today. Hershey's, the chocolate people, is working with Google, the everything people, to tailor digital Halloween ads to you. Seems they can tell whether you are more likely to let your kids go outside to trick or treat, for instance, based on what you've been searching for, and so will serve you ads, say with kids in costumes out running around. If they think you're going to stay in, it's kids eating candy inside. It's weird. Creepy, indeed. All right, we're going, but here's your Tuesday moment of economic context. First comes to us courtesy of the American Enterprise Institute as we await Senate Republicans deciding what they want to do to help the pandemic economy. A vote this week, apparently, according to Senator Mitch McConnell. Anyway, AEI has a new study out. how much state and local governments are going to be short revenue-wise because of the virus. We've talked about this, right? Terrible tax revenues, more expenses. Not a good situation. Anyway, AEI says states and cities are looking at a combined $240 billion budget gap. That's $250 billion for this fiscal year. Our digital and on-demand team includes Ufuk Mehmetoglu, Olga Oxman, Beth Perlman, Erica Phillips, Brian Ronahan, and Tony Wagner. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.